Good afternoon and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. Happy New Year 2025. From the January issue of Costco Connection, Plant Power, Add More Plant-Based Food to Your Meals by Susan Denzer. When cooking for better health, one food category consistently tops the list: plants. Plants fuel our bodies with vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants that can help lower inflammation, boost productivity and mood, and fight diseases. Plants also add color, texture, moisture, and depth of flavor to cooking. Yet the thought of increasing the amount of plants in meals can feel daunting. By adopting a few new cooking strategies, it will soon be second nature. Amp up leafy greens. Leafy greens are a versatile, easy starting point. Sauté spinach or Swiss chard with onions and garlic for egg dishes. Place a handful of arugula on baked pizza. Add kale, collard, or bok choy to soups, stews, stir-fries, pasta, and grain dishes. Broaden protein sources. Foods such as edamame, lentils, chickpeas, tofu, quinoa, nuts, and seeds are terrific plant-based protein sources for any dietary approach. Incorporate them into burgers, soups, stews, pastas, salads, and more to replace or supplement animal-based protein. Choose veggie noodles or rice. Spiralized or riced vegetables provide a delightful twist on the usual. Make your own using fresh cauliflower, zucchini, squash, or sweet potatoes. Or purchase ready-made or pre-cut options to use in salads or steam, sauté, stir-fry, or roast in place of pasta or grains. Don't forget fruit. Fruit possesses amazing sweetening and brightening powers. Include grapes, berries, or grapefruit in salads. Nestle sliced avocado or pears into sandwiches. Add dried cranberries, apricots, or raisins to oatmeal, stews, and cheese trays. Bake apples for a comforting dessert. Try plant-based milk. Plant-based milks add a rich, creamy texture to many recipes. Replace heavy cream with an equal amount of unsweetened and unflavored oat, almond, or coconut milk in sauces, oatmeal, rice, or casseroles. Whether you're adding a plant-based ingredient to your meals a few times a week or every day, increasing the amount of plants in your cooking is within easy reach. Become a plant-based explorer in your kitchen. From the Sun Lake Splash, a winter favorite by Danette Hunnell. The dianthus plant thrives in Sun Lakes during January. Even after cold, rainy days, they remain bright and healthy, kicking off the new year with pretty colors. They are familiar in the valley as a winter annual. However, if protected from the summer sun and with plenty of water during hot months, they can last year-round. The plant won't bloom during summer, but remains as a little bush in a tight mound. Dianthus have silver-green leaves, and the flowers can be pink, white, red, or lavender. The eyes can feature different coloring in the center. Some have an appearance of being streaked. The blooms begin during the cooler months and remain until April. Dianthus flowers rise above the leaves from 2 to 12 inches. They will reseed themselves, continuing to spread if not deadheaded. Pruning should happen in the fall or when the flower begins to look shriveled, and again in the spring. Deadhead by cutting the stems to just above the point where the side stem joins the main plant. Dianthus are rich in nectar, attracting butterflies and hummingbirds. Their fragrance, some say, is similar to dryer sheets. Fertilize your plant once a month if you are traveling for a long while. Just add a slow-release fertilizer into the soil around the base of the plant once a year. Dianthus are happiest in well-draining soil. Water once a week unless it rains, and try to water at the base of the plant and not on the flower itself. It's good to let them dry between waterings. Perlite mixed in the soil is helpful. If using a planter, be sure it has drain holes or add stones on the very bottom. Dianthus do best in the winter with at least 6 hours of full sun, and they can tolerate a light frost but will perish from a hard freeze. Cover with a pillowcase or burlap. The lifespan of Dianthus is approximately 4 years, after which time they will get woody and scraggly looking with no more blooms. They are easy to propagate. Place cuttings with at least one node from a non-flowering shoot in a small pot with dark alkaline soil. Make sure the node is below the soil and keep damp with 5 hours of sun. New leaves should appear in about a month. Dianthus are subtle, low-to-the-ground, small flowers that are easy to care for and are clean-looking. They make your yard look nice and well cared for, even when you don't have a lot of time. From the Arizona Republic, The Hidden History of Former Arizona Roadside Oasis Cactus Garden by Douglas C. Town. Cactus Garden was a roadside establishment that once touted itself as the showplace of the desert and offered relief from asthma, arthritis, and other ailments. Yet, this seemingly magical place has vanished off the map. The reason for its disappearance are complicated, but they involve an old real estate axiom: location, 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 and few taking the road less traveled. Cactus Garden opened its doors in the mid-1930s, perched on a modest ridge 8 miles southeast of Wickenburg. A Continental Oil Company gas station operated out of a stone building adorned with palm fronds and an adjacent botanical collection showcasing the region's plant oddities. This exotic business was a beacon for motorists on U.S. Highway 60, 70, 89, then the main drag from Phoenix to Southern California or Prescott. The service station proudly advertised Conoco Bronze Gasoline and offered expert repairing for autos. A cafe for motorists doubled as a trading post, selling curios and refreshing beer. The Cactus Garden Lodge was a tourist court at the rear of the property, which boasted perpetual sunshine, dry air, purified over a windswept natural laboratory of desert and mountains, in a 1939 ad in the Arizona Republic. Its 8 furnished cottages were advertised as a haven where travelers could seek relief from asthma, arthritis, and other ailments. At the time, the two lanes of U.S. 60, 70, 89 near Cactus Garden had sinuous curves that followed the contours of the land, including up a ridge to the gas station and lodge. But as early highways were prone to do, the blacktop shifted. By 1964, a highway realignment had left the business stranded on a seldom-used meander. Instead of curving up to Cactus Garden, the winding road was straightened, leaving it 1,000 feet from the gas station and lodge. By 1992, the service station was gone. Still, a large sign encouraged drivers to take the bypass segment to what was then called the Garden City Motel Lodge, which offered apartments and kitchenettes on an overnight, weekly, and monthly basis. Today, the once public cottages have found new life as private residences, retaining many original elements. And the lodge's namesake, Cactus Garden? It remains next to where the gas station once stood, even more impressive with its decades of added growth and enduring legacy of a vintage roadside business. From Phoenix Home and Garden Magazine, Desert Rose Romance: Tips for Growing Adeniums by Laurie A. Johnson. Dan Smith was addicted to adeniums. Commonly known as desert rose, these native plants of Africa come in a plethora of species and hybrids perfectly suited for the low desert's hot, arid conditions. For the Mesa resident, one glimpse of the unusual cordyceform succulents led to a passion for cultivating them. When initially planning his garden, Dan was attracted to the tropical look of plumeria and thought they'd make a unique plant to grow in a desert environment. But a chance sighting of an adenium caught his fancy. He was hooked. I love the unique look of the caudics. They don't take as long as plumeria to blossom, they take less space, and the flowers are nice, he said. I've been growing adeniums for more than 10 years now. Ultimately, his collection consisted of nearly 300 individual plants representing virtually every known variety. I believe I have all except for Adenium multiflorum, he said, noting, I lost that this spring. Each plant in Dan's collection was tagged and in a numbered pot, which he tracked in a custom database. I enter the date and what action I perform, such as up-potting, trimming, or seed planting. I add the pot number, the family, genus, and species of the plant, and a plant and or blossom description. Sometimes I even include a photograph, Dan explained. He also included the source of each plant, as many were ordered from overseas growers. I've gotten seeds or plants from Australia, China, India, Puerto Rico, South Africa, Taiwan, and Thailand, he said. One plant from Pakistan arrived packaged in nothing more than a heavy cloth bag with Dan's address written directly on it. The plant, a hybrid of A. obesum, remained one of Dan's favorites, of which he had several, including his very first acquisition, beloved for its sentimental value, which was bent at a 90-degree angle. An unusual created adenium and a monstrous variety, both from Thailand, also were at the top of the list. I had a hard time finding these, so I value them, Dan recalled. The crested plant had a difficult trip here. It was broken in a number of spots when I received it. Other favorite standouts, including an Aswasicum purchased at the Desert Botanical Garden and his first import, a cultivar called Star of Happiness. Another cultivar, Dachshund, is credited with starting the multi-petal blossom trend, while the Dorset Horn earned its place on his list when only three of the 90 seeds he tried to grow developed. Getting his hands dirty, Dan grew upwards of 75% of his plants from seed in a small greenhouse he built in his backyard. Because I can control the temperature and somewhat the humidity, it's a great place to germinate seeds and grow seedlings, he said. Until an adenium gets big enough to go outside, it stays in the greenhouse. I love growing plants from seed. Give me a seed that's impossible to germinate or grow, and I'll take on that challenge any day. He also built benches that display his collection during the summer, as well as a shade house above them. In the fall, he disassembled the benches and moved the plants to the patio, garage, greenhouse, and even the house for the winter, then set up everything up in the yard again in the spring. One feature he tried to highlight was the multitude of available bloom colors. If you look at the blossoms of the true species plant, such as Aobesum, you will find that they are light red and pink with little variation. All other colors come from the zillions of hybrids that are out there now. They include some form of red or pink with different stripes or formations. Whites have been around for a while also. Only recently have the hybridizers developed yellows and blacks and now orange and even some bluish picotee, Dan explained. I still haven't found a yellow that won't fade to white with our low humidity and bright sun. I get less fade in my greenhouse where those issues are moderated. Bloom size can range from 1 inch to across to as large as 4 inches, and many new hybrids feature multi-petal blooms. Sculptural appeal. Another characteristic of interest to adenium aficionados is the shape of the caudex, or woody tree-like stem. If the shape is interesting enough, who cares about the flower? Dan joked. To have a beautiful bloom plus an interesting shape is a bonus. Dan noted there are basically two forms of caudex, the enlarged twisted roots and the bulbous mass. There are also cultivars known as Thai Soko, which are grown to have a very large caudex and multiple stems, he added. His wish list included obtaining adenium species collected from the wild, and he sought a yellow variety that doesn't fade, as well as a good orange blossom. I'm slowly expanding my succulent collection, Dan said. I love all the caudiciform plants. If it's unique and hard to grow, I want it. Now, here are some tips for growing adeniums. The growing season for adeniums is April to October in the Sonoran Desert. Give plants at least 4 hours of sun or more, including full sun for large plants during this time. Plant adeniums in a fast-draining soil, such as a cactus mix with additional pumice and coir chips. It is virtually impossible to overwater during the hot months. Water approximately 3 times per week, making sure that each plant receives enough water to run out of the bottom of the pot. Fertilize regularly. Apply a low nitrogen fertilizer as often as every 2 weeks. Adeniums go dormant when temperatures dip below 50 degrees. During this time, protect plants from winter cold. Bring them indoors or place in a greenhouse. Do not water when plants are dormant, as they are susceptible to rot. Here's another article from Phoenix Home and Garden magazine, How to Successfully Grow Fruit Trees in the Arid Southwest, by Nancy Erdman. While there are many benefits to having fruit trees in your garden, being able to enjoy the tasty harvests is about as good as it gets. There are a variety of species that thrive in the valley's hot, dry climate, from tangelos, apples, and limes, to apricots, oranges, and berries. Aside from their natural abundance, fruit trees also attract birds, bees, and butterflies, also offer shade during the summer, and produce fragrant blossoms that beautify any yard. Sounds like a win-win situation no matter how you look at it. Here's how to get started. Selecting the right trees. For optimum fruit production in the low desert, experts at the Maricopa County Cooperative Extension recommend choosing deciduous tree varieties that have low chilling requirements, bear early maturing fruit, and self-pollinate. Chill hours are the amount of cold weather needed for a tree to set fruit. Maricopa County has 300 to 400 chill hours annually, so selecting varieties with 250 or so chilling hours should provide a solid crop each year once the plants are established. Be sure to select trees with fruit that ripens before the heat of summer arrives so that your produce doesn't burn. Also, many species require cross-pollination in order to set fruit, making it imperative that you have two of the same type of tree, and in some cases one of each gender, in your yard in order to yield an adequate crop. When and where to plant. The ideal time to plant depends on the type of tree and if it is potted or bare roots, says grower Dwayne Hebert, co-owner of Edge of Nowhere Farm in Whitman. Potted trees can go in the ground October through March, while bare root trees are typically planted in January and February. When decided on where in the landscape to place your tree, your best bet is to find a spot with an eastern exposure as it provides afternoon shade, says urban permaculture designer and owner of the Urban Farm in Phoenix, Greg Peterson. Avoid growing fruit trees in a hot microclimate, especially those with a western exposure, unless there's some form of late-day shade. I tell people to go stand for 15 minutes on an August afternoon in an area where they want to plant and see if they would want to live there, Peterson chokes. No matter where in the yard you grow your fruit tree, whether in bare dirt or grass, be sure to dig a basin around the plant and fill it with woody mulch. This buffers the tree from the lawn's watering schedule, builds healthy soil around its base, and if it's planted in the lawn, allows it to get established before Bermuda grass can do any damage by using up all the soil's nutrients, Peterson explains. It's all in the soil. The single biggest thing you can do to successfully grow anything in the desert is to have healthy soil, Peterson continues. If you plant a tree in our native dirt, which contains less than 1% organic matter, it's probably going to die. Healthy soil creates a layer of insulation by holding in moisture and keeping the ground cooler in summer and warmer in winter. There are five components to healthy soil: dirt, air, space, water, organic matter, and the microorganisms that live in it. Dirt is simply broken down rock that is highly compacted, making it almost impossible to grow anything in it. The good news is that all you need to do is add lots of organic matter to it, the plant expert remarks. He recommends augmenting native earth with a good soil mix you can find at a local nursery. If you're going to spend 40% of your garden budget on a tree, expect to spend at least that much on supplements and soil, he remarks. If someone plants a tree in dirt with gravel, the tree likely won't make it and their investment will be lost. Trees are either sold in containers or as bare roots. Bare root trees come with their roots wrapped in bags, often filled with moist wood shavings or sawdust, and are less expensive than pot-grown trees. According to Cornell University Department of Horticulture, a bare root tree contains 200% more roots than the same tree sold bald and boxed. Local nurseries often have a larger selection of bare root trees, and they are easier to handle due to their light weight. Bare root plants also experience less transplant shock and start establishing themselves more quickly than containerized ones. The downside is that while potted trees can be found year-round, bare root varieties are only available for a limited time, usually November through March. In addition, sometimes trees in pots can start bearing fruit a year or two sooner than bare root. Planting basics. Dig a square, not round, hole that is at least 1.5 times the size of the pot. A good place to start is by digging 12 inches deep and 2 feet out, which also works for a bare root tree. Because much of the desert's native soil is caliche, a hard layer of dirt that is almost impossible to penetrate, planting in a circular opening forces roots to hit the sides of the hole and continue in circles, essentially root-bounding themselves. In a square hole, when roots hit a corner, they won't make a 90-degree turn, but will instead continue growing straight into the native soil. It's also a good idea to cut divots into the sides of the hole so that the surface is not smooth and the roots have a place in which to grow. Place 40% of the displaced native soil into a wheelbarrow. This dirt contains necessary minerals and will be returned to the hole when the tree is planted. Toss aside the remaining 60% of native soil and substitute it in the wheelbarrow with a good planting mix consisting mostly of compost, pine bark, perlite, a naturally occurring mineral glass often found in commercial potting blends and presents like small white styrofoam balls, and cocopeat, a growing medium made of coconut husks. This mixture introduces microbes that are able to harvest the minerals out of the native dirt and make it bioavailable to plants. Add 2 pounds of azomite, 2 pounds of worm castings, and 2 pounds of mycorrhizal fungi to the mix in the wheelbarrow. These supplements can be purchased online or found at local nurseries and at hardware, feed, and livestock stores. Stir up the soil mixture. Add a shovelful to the bottom of your planting hole and place the tree in the pit with the graft point where it's attached to the rootstock, 3 to 5 inches above the soil. Fill in the rest of the hole with the mix from the wheelbarrow, making sure to cover the root flare, visible roots. Top with mulch. Peterson observes the 6-6 rule, 6 inches of woody mulch placed in a 6-foot diameter circle around the base of the tree. He follows up with an additional 6 inches of woody mulch once or twice a year. When the interspace between the dirt and woody mulch breaks down, it makes incredible soil. We are essentially mimicking the process that happens in a forest, he explains. Within a few years, the dirt turns into a dark, deep, nice soil. Water thoroughly to a depth of 3 feet. Consider planting cover crops such as sweet potato vines or cowpeas around the tree's base to shade it during the hot summer months, help build healthy soil, and collect nutrients that can be used by the tree. Cover crops love the heat and can be on the same watering schedule as a fruit tree. Watering. People think trees need to be watered every day, but they don't. Too much water and the roots rot. Not enough and the roots dry out. Either way, the damage looks the same, Peterson says. My experience with all of the fruit trees I've ever planted is once you get them past the first year and they're established, water once a month in winter and twice a month in summer. Trees need to be deep watered throughout their entire basin to a depth of 3 feet. A soil probe or water meter can help you determine if you've penetrated the soil enough. If you have a bubbler in the basin, set it to run 3 to 4 hours each time and completely fill the basin. If you have drip irrigation, a good solution is to buy a drip ring with emitters set in a circle that plugs into your drip system. Do not, however, use chlorinated water as it will kill essential microorganisms. Fertilizing. Fertilize at regular intervals. For newly planted trees, we use a light fertilizer, preferably fish emulsion with vitamin B, Hebert says. The rest of the year, typically in February, May, and September, use time-released pelletized fertilizers. I like to think of the holidays that surround that as a reminder, Valentine's Day, Memorial Day, and Labor Day, he adds. You can also use a liquid fertilizer instead of pelletized. If you do this, you may need to feed monthly just before and during the growing season, which is between late February and October or November. When to expect fruit? The classic question is how long before I get food from my tree, Peterson says. Usually it takes about 3 years. He suggests taking off all of the fruit in the first year if anything shows up and before it starts to take shape. What we're trying to do is get the tree to establish roots, not make fruit, he explains. Year 2, remove most of the fruit so that by year 3, you have a good root system established and the tree is producing regularly. It goes something like this: no fruit the first and second years, a few pieces the third year, exponentially more the fourth year, and by the fifth year, oh my God. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book called Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called The Garden Guard. It was written by Tom Kovac. And there's a quote here from Jean-Jacques Rousseau. What wisdom can you find that is greater than kindness? The Garden Guard. Both my parents, Hungarian immigrants, were born with green thumbs. Our family of 10 depended on the food we grew in our huge vegetable garden. My mother canned much of the produce for winter, and my father sold potatoes and cabbage to the local stores and high schools. Our garden was the pride of the neighborhood. But then one summer, when I was quite young, we had a problem. Someone was stealing some of our vegetables. My parents were dumbfounded. "I don't get it," my father said. "If someone wants vegetables from us, all they have to do is ask. If they can't afford to pay for them, they could just have them." And then one of the neighbors tipped us off that an old bachelor who lived a short distance from us was seen selling some vegetables in a nearby town. Didn't take long for my parents to put two and two together. Benny did not have a garden. So he was obviously getting his vegetables from someone else's garden. Now, Benny was not a bad old fellow. My dad often hired him for haying and other odd jobs just to help him out. He had no steady job and lived in a small cabin that looked rather bleak to me. My parents figured he was taking our vegetables to earn a few extra dollars. But stealing is stealing, and it just isn't right. My father decided how to handle this situation his own way. "I'm going to hire Benny," he announced one day. "What?" my mother exclaimed. "Joseph, we don't have enough money to hire anyone. Besides, why would we hire the man who's taking our vegetables?" My father just smiled and said, "Trust me, I've got a plan." "What are you going to do?" "I'm going to hire him to guard our garden." My mother shook her head. "What? That's like hiring the fox to watch the hen house." "Well," my father said, "here's what I think. Benny's got himself backed into a corner, and I'm going to give him a way out. The way I figure it, he can't turn me down." When my father approached him about the job, Benny was obviously a bit shocked. "Benny," he said, "someone, probably some kids, has been taking vegetables out of our garden. I wonder if I could hire you to guard it for me." Well, Benny hemmed and hawed for a bit, but after Dad explained that he would also be eating supper with us, he finally agreed. Needless to say, there were no vegetables missing the next day, and whether or not Benny slept most of the night was not important. The fact was that Dad's plan was working. We were not missing any vegetables, and Benny had a job of sorts. I don't think my folks could have been paying him much, but he was being paid, and just having a job gave Benny more than a little pride. That solved our problem. But that wasn't the end of the story. Things worked out even better than my father had planned. You see, each morning after Benny got done guarding the garden, he'd stick around long enough for breakfast and then follow us around in the garden. Now, Benny got to liking this garden business. He'd ask questions like, "Why do you plant these carrots here? How come some of these peas are growing faster than those over there?" My parents were patient with him, answering all his questions. And then my father suggested, "You know, Benny, the growing season is just about over, but I could take my team over to your place and plow you up a nice patch of ground where you could plant a garden next spring." "You'd do that?" Benny asked. "Certainly," my father replied. By the following spring, Benny had his garden spot all plowed, disced, and ready for planting. In fact, my parents gave him various seeds that he could use. As we drove by his place in our old rattletrap car one day, Dad slowed down and pointed at Benny's garden. "Look at that, would you? He's growing nicer sweet corn than we are, and he's so busy gardening that he doesn't have time to guard our garden. Of course, for some reason, we don't need a garden guide anymore." That's called The Garden Guard, written by Tom Kovac, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the gardener's soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.